Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Bankruptcy Jurisdiction Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 14, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Wellness International Network v. Sharif, which presents two questions. The first is whether a bankruptcy court has power under Article 1 of the Constitution to determine where an issue of state property law is involved, that property in the debtor's possession belongs to the bankruptcy estate. The second question is whether, notwithstanding the limits of Article 1 authority, the consent of litigants can permit a bankruptcy court to exercise Article 3 judicial power, and if so, whether a litigant's continued participation in litigation can constitute implied consent. To discuss the case, we have Thomas Plank, who is the Joel A. Katz Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Tennessee College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Plank.
This case involves two issues: whether a bankruptcy court has the constitutional power to adjudicate and to enter final judgment on what constitutes property of the bankruptcy estate, and if not, whether the parties may nevertheless consent to such final adjudication by the bankruptcy court, and whether that consent may be implied. The respondent, Richard Sharif, had sued Wellness International Network Limited, the petitioner, in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas, in 2003-2004 time period, but after a long-running battle in which Sharif failed to provide discovery, the district court in 2008 entered summary judgment against Sharif for over $650,000 in litigation costs in favor of Wellness. Wellness then pursued further discovery of Sharif's property to try to satisfy the judgment, but Sharif ignored court orders compelling discovery and, instead of complying, filed a bankruptcy petition in the Northern District of Illinois, listing Wellness as a creditor, along with other family members alleged to be creditors. Wellness was the only person to file a proof of claim in the bankruptcy case. Wellness had learned that Sharif had claimed to own property worth over $5 million on a loan application to the now-defunct Washington Mutual. But in the bankruptcy proceedings, Sharif asserted that he had lied on his loan application and that these loan assets were held in a trust of which he was trustee. However, Sharif failed to provide sufficient documentation of this trust and information on his assets. In response, Wellness filed an adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy court seeking a determination that he be denied a discharge in bankruptcy, and also that the trust should be considered Sharif's, quote, alter ego, close quote, and the assets of the trust should be included in Sharif's bankruptcy estate. After a continual failure to respond to discovery and a warning by the bankruptcy court entered final default judgment for Wellness on all counts, plus more attorney's fees and costs. Sharif appealed to the district court, which affirmed, and then Sharif appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. The Court of Appeals affirmed the judgment denying discharge, but reversed the judgment that the trust was Sharif's alter ego, and therefore the trust assets were part of Sharif's bankruptcy estate. The court held that Wellness's claim that the alleged trust was the alter ego of Sharif, and that the trust assets should be included in the bankruptcy estate, was like the compulsory counterclaim that Vicki Marshall, the debtor in bankruptcy, had asserted against a creditor, her stepson, J. Howard Marshall, for tortious interference with a gift from her husband and Howard Marshall's father. The United States Supreme Court in 2011, Stern v. Marshall, held the bankruptcy court did not have the constitutional authority to enter final judgment on such a compulsory counterclaim. Further, the Seventh Circuit held that the question of the bankruptcy court's constitutional authority could not be waived by the parties because the question involved not just the rights of the parties to an adjudication by an Article III judge, but also raised constitutional structural concerns about the allocation of power between Congress and the judiciary. This ruling was necessary because, although Stern had been decided a month and a half before opening briefs were due in the district court, Sharif had failed to raise Stern as an issue until much later, and arguably had waived his objection to the bankruptcy court's final adjudication authority. The two issues before the Supreme Court are difficult issues. First, regarding the bankruptcy court's authority to adjudicate questions about what is property of the estate, the claim presented in Wellness appears to be substantially different from the claim that was the subject of Stern v. Marshall. Bankruptcy courts and their predecessors, including the commissioners of bankrupt under the English Bankrupt Acts before, in effect before and at the time of the adoption of the United States Constitution, have long adjudicated these kinds of questions. One way to illustrate the difference from the compulsory counterclaim in Stern is to note that there was no issue in Stern whether Vicki Marshall's claim belonged to her and was therefore an interest in property that became part of her bankruptcy estate under Section 541A1 of the Bankruptcy Code. The sticking point in Stern was not what was in the estate, but how does the bankruptcy trustee realize the property of the estate? That is, how does the trustee recover on the claim for tortious interference? This was also the issue in Northern Pipeline Construction Company v. Marathon Pipeline Construction Company, which in 1982 held that the original bankruptcy code had gone too far in allowing a bankruptcy court to adjudicate a debtor's contract claim against a person that had not filed a claim in the case and was not a creditor in the bankruptcy case. Again, that contract right was property of the estate, but the court held that the bankruptcy court could not adjudicate that claim. Hence, the distinction appears to be between what interests are included in the bankruptcy estate and how does the bankruptcy trustee realize on those interests. On the other hand, the existence and the nature of the claim in this case and the claims in Stern and in Marathon depend equally on state law. The Bankruptcy Code defines what is property of the estate in Section 541, but the most important component of that definition is what are the interests of the debtor in property. The Bankruptcy Code does not define what are interests in property, and in my view, Congress doesn't even have the constitutional authority under the Bankruptcy Clause to make such a determination. In both types of claims, the Bankruptcy Court must analyze and apply state law, or in some instances not relevant here, other non-bankruptcy laws such as federal patent law. Thus, when a court begins to dig into the question of whether assets should be included in the bankruptcy estate, it becomes much harder to create a rule that distinguishes the claim in this case from the claim in Stern or Marathon. For example, determining property of the estate may affect other persons who are not parties to the bankruptcy case. In this case, Wellness asserted that the trust was Sharif's alter ego. As the Seventh Circuit noted, the question of alter ego under applicable state law is very complicated. Now, I'm not sure why this formulation was chosen by Wellness. It seems to me the question is whether Sharif owned assets in his own right or held them as trustee for a trust for the benefit of some other person. But this formulation raises the question about the role of the beneficiary of the trust, who may not be before the bankruptcy court. In either case, the process and effect of adjudicating whether these assets were owned by or should be treated as owned by Sharif and therefore should be included in the bankruptcy estate is hard to distinguish from the process and effect of adjudicating whether Vicki Marshall was entitled to damages for tortious interference with a gift, which was the claim in Stern. Notwithstanding these difficulties, I think that the Supreme Court will try to find a way to hold that this type of claim is not a, quote, Stern claim, and that the bankruptcy courts have constitutional authority in their final judgment. Otherwise, the implications for administering the bankruptcy code become staggering, since every case involves determining what are the assets that are included in the bankruptcy estate. On the question of consent, I do not fully understand the reasoning of the Seventh Circuit that allowing consent implicates the separation of powers that serve to protect the judicial branch from encroachment by the legislative branch or the executive branch and therefore are not waivable by the private parties. I'm not an expert in this aspect of federal jurisdiction, but I could certainly see the problem if Congress mandated that certain disputes not be adjudicated by Article III judges. But I don't understand why allowing consent to adjudication by non-Article III adjudicators is problematic as long as the consent is freely and knowingly given and not subject to coercion. On the other hand, I do see some issues with implied consent, and again, the point is the consent really does have to be knowing and freely given. In any event, the decision that parties may not consent to adjudication by non-Article III adjudicators has implications much broader than the Bankruptcy Code. It would affect the role and powers of magistrates in federal courts, and possibly the validity of private arbitration of claims that would be eligible for adjudication by Article III courts. Again, I would think that if the court reaches the issue, the court would uphold some form of consent to bankruptcy court final adjudication. Another fascinating aspect of this case is that the court need not decide both issues unless it were to uphold the Seventh Circuit completely. If the court decides that a bankruptcy court has the constitutional authority to decide the property of the estate issue, in this case, and reverses the Seventh Circuit on this point, then it need not decide the consent issue. But there is a split of authority on the consent issue, and there is a substantial need for resolution of this question, since there are many other potential Stern claims out there. Similarly, if the court decides that consent is permissible, that the consent may be implied from failure timely to object to the adjudication by the bankruptcy court, and that Sharif consented to bankruptcy court final adjudication, then there is no need to decide the question of the constitutional authority of the bankruptcy court in this case. However, the uncertainty on this point is also causing tremendous uncertainty, delay, and costs in bankruptcy and federal courts. Indeed, at the oral argument, some members of the court raised the question whether the court could rule in favor of the petitioner Wellness on both counts, even though there's only a need to decide one or the other. It will be fascinating to see what the court does with this case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.